Air pollution is expensive. Its price tag can be calculated in healthcare costs.
When I would try to inhale, I mean, it just hurt so bad I couldn't inhale.
I'm Kara Holsoppel. This week on the Allegheny Front, we look at why the costs associated with pollution are actually going down. And it's only February, but the natural gas industry is already having a bad year. Plus, one listener noticed a bird she's never seen in her backyard in the wintertime.
I don't know what it's eating, as insects are nowhere to be seen.
We'll get to the bottom of that and more environmental stories coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Landowners across Pennsylvania continue to battle new natural gas pipeline projects, while companies continue to build and plan for tens of thousands of miles of new pipe. Thursday, the state waded into this conflict with a large set of pipeline recommendations. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports.
The 184 recommendations span 300 pages. Some would require regulatory changes, others would need new legislation, and some would only happen if the industry volunteered. Department of Environmental Protection Secretary John Quigley says a key recommendation is for pipeline companies to engage local communities early and often.
It is very easy for local opposition to these projects to throw sand in the gears and to slow things down. And to these pipeline development companies, time is money, and folks know how to play the game.
Quigley should know. Pipeline opponents protested the meetings he chaired as head of the governor's Pipeline Infrastructure Task Force. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
We'll have more natural gas news later in the show. But first, we often hear about the economic costs of environmental regulations for the energy industry. But there's a flip side to that equation, the price we pay for pollution. One scientist has added up those costs and found they're going down. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier found out why.
For years, scientists have known that air pollution from burning fossil fuels is bad for us. But can we place a dollar amount on the hidden costs of burning coal and other fossil fuels for electricity? One person who wanted to know was Paulina Jaramillo.
I study the environmental impacts of energy systems.
So the Carnegie Mellon scientist called up a colleague. They designed a model to find out. The researchers plugged in pollution reports from the EPA, weather models, and population data. They took into account the effects of pollution on crops, forests, and infrastructure, and human health. Much of that cost hinges on one basic number. And it's kind of a creepy number.
Value of a statistical life, which is a number widely used in policy analyses to estimate mortality costs.
The value of a statistical life. It's basically the amount of money we as a society are willing to spend to save someone's life. And according to the federal government, it's around $6 million these days. What the scientists found was pretty clear. Since the early 2000s, emissions from coal-fired power plants have been going down. And because of this, Jaramillo found that the annual cost of pollution declined by about 25% to $130 billion.
Because we started reducing those emissions, we reduced health impacts. These models cannot pinpoint who specifically benefited, but on a population basis, there are benefits.
So what happened? Jaramillo says the big change is that new regulations forced many coal-fired power plants to clean up. The Great Recession lowered demand for energy for a few years, and cleaner sources like natural gas have cut into coal's share of the electricity market. Though these costs may be going down, the price tag the researchers calculated is still around $400 a year for every person in the U.S. Where can you see these costs play out in real life? You can try the emergency room at Allegheny General Hospital in Pittsburgh.
Over here, we have our X-ray suite. So we have most of these patients that you're involved in, they will require some type of X-ray study to see if they've developed a pneumonia, for example, on top of their underlying condition.
Arvind Venkit is an emergency physician at the hospital. Venkit says his patients will come in because of a cold or allergic reaction. But the underlying causes include lots of other factors, including air pollution.
What happens a lot with these patients is that either allergies due to air pollution or they get a virus of some sort that really triggers them to require acute care. And pollution is a well-recognized trigger.
Studies show that ER visits for heart and lung conditions go up on days when pollution is highest. And at around $1,000 a pop, costs for ER visits for people with breathing problems can add up.
And you have your inhaler at home?
I have it with me here.
You do?
Okay.
That cost was visible one day last year when 60-year-old Linda Dever visited the emergency room.
By 3 o'clock this morning, I woke up. The whole right side, I couldn't breathe. Mm-hmm. And when I would try to inhale, I mean, it just hurt so bad, I couldn't inhale.
Dever was a smoker until a few years ago. But since being diagnosed with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, she's been to the ER about once a year.
Like, I drive a school bus, and when I leave the lot and walk up to my car, it's just a little bit of a grade. As soon as I get in my car, I have to get my inhaler out and use my inhaler because I can't breathe.
There's no way of knowing whether pollution in Pittsburgh's air had anything to do with Dever's breathing problems that day. But pollution has been shown to cause the same types of symptoms that make lung conditions like hers worse, and an ER visit more likely. For Jaramillo of Carnegie Mellon, the takeaway from her study is simple.
Well, I think my take is that we need to keep doing, like, we need to continue regulating these emissions and putting controls on these emissions because they have been effective.
And if emissions from places like coal plants continue to decline, so will their costs. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Now let's look at energy from another perspective. A new anthology of poems, essays, and stories explores issues surrounding fracking for oil and gas. It's called Fracture and includes the work of 50 writers from around the country. Poet Susan Truxell-Sauter is one of them. I spoke with her from a studio at West Virginia Public Broadcasting about her piece in the book. Many of the writers in the book have a personal connection to fracking. It's on their land or in their communities. What's been your experience with fracking as a resident of West Virginia?
It's so emotional for me. It hasn't happened yet to us, but I feel like I am laying on a railroad track and it's going to happen and I'm going to lose everything. But we did see a little bit about what fracking was going to do to our farm. We have 128 acres in Preston County. When this whole thing about fracking came out, all of a sudden we were seeing these like blue tanker trucks and we'd hear this like gigantic, I was like, what is going on? And then they'd come up past our house. They were fracking wells vertically. We did not know that. It was just a frightening time. It was loud. We couldn't keep our windows open. So that's my very personal connection.
The title of your poem in the anthology is The Academy Awards of Expendable. It reads like an acceptance speech. What's the concept behind the poem?
I literally was watching the Academy Awards. You know, the work that comes out on films really does move me, but the whole award ceremony, the audience, et cetera, it was just hyperbolic, you know, the baubles on the arms and the dresses and the men with all, you know, I just thought, what would an Academy Awards of West Virginia look like? There are three voices, and I start out by calling out the guilty, all of us. We took too much, you know. So that's the first voice. And the next voice, I have the MC tell everybody to drink up their Marcellus martinis. And then West Virginia comes to the podium, and she speaks. And I think, you know, West Virginians, I think we're very confused about what we are to be proud of. We've sacrificed so much. My farm has been strip mined already. Our waters have been polluted. Our tourism industry was destroyed in Preston County. The rivers are orange. And yet we're proud, but we're kind of confused about that. So that's where that last voice of West Virginia, kind of how she approaches her thanks to everyone.
Will you read that third section of the poem?
I sure will. I sure will here. I want to thank the titans of industry, my producers, the consumers, the stunning script, my stunned surface, the neighbors who sold out, the directors of Apocalypse. I share this award with all, including the vigilant E. Gordon Gee, bow-tied, tongue-tied board members who sat at the table of the largest mining disaster in recent history. And for you, the audience so adorned, let me thank fur-bearing animals for dying. The canaries, too, as our oxygen thins worldwide.
Can you explain briefly who E. Gordon Gee is?
Let's see. He has been president of quite a few universities. When he was president of Ohio State, he also was the head of the Safety, Health, and Policy Committee of Massey. He served 9 years on that committee during the time of the Big Branch mining disaster. And that is what West Virginia, you know, in her acceptance speech in my poem is referring to.
Throughout the poem and in the section that you just read, you do connect West Virginia's long history of coal mining to this current wave of fracking for natural gas. Just talk a little bit more about how you see the relationship between the two.
We have a script that we've done before. West Virginia knows how to do this. And they don't know how to do anything else. I don't think we know how to claim what is rightfully ours. A good, safe life that on land that we can go back to, that it will be there.
Who are some of the other people that are being thanked? You mentioned fur-bearing animals. Who are they?
I just pictured all these people in an audience, you know, as West Virginia is speaking to this Academy Award group. Maybe they had mink stoles on. It's all of us. And I struggle with that. I mean, it's easy to proclaim care, you know, about it, but it's harder to put our care into action. But there are consequences if we don't. And I am so angry. And I think that poem has a lot of anger in it.
Mm-hmm. And a little bit of humor as well.
Yeah, I think it's hilarious. I couldn't believe some of the stuff I was writing. I was like, oh, my gosh. And yet I don't. We're all so sensitive here in West Virginia about ourselves, you know, and it's an uncomfortable position to be putting myself in to kind of be poking fun. But I think we have to.
How does poetry address complicated, controversial subjects like fracking differently than journalism or even other arts like documentary filmmaking?
I think with poetry, you're given more license for emotion and also for the reader to maybe experience more of their own selves in the poem. I've tried polemically, you know, sit down and write a piece. I actually went and visited a wellhead and 7,000 words ensued from a piece about it. It's like a concentrated punch, poetry is. It's a good summary. It's a good kick-in-the-pants summary of where we've been.
Susan Truxell-Sauter is a writer from West Virginia. You can read her entire poem, Academy Awards of Expendable, at our website, alleghenyfront.org. This is The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. What's gray has white bars on its tail and can mimic a car alarm.
They may be a species that more of them are choosing not to migrate south for the winter in warmer years.
We'll find out more about this mystery bird of winter, spotted by one of our listeners, later on the Allegheny Front. Don't go away. Even though natural gas is an important energy player with plans for pipelines zigzagging across the region, 2016 has gotten off to a rough start for Pennsylvania's Marcellus shale industry. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports natural gas drillers are laying off workers and cutting spending in the face of low natural gas prices.
The sound of humming drill rigs has been tapering off lately. It's been happening for a while now, but this year the industry is going through a particularly rough patch. One prime example is Cabot Oil and Gas, earlier this month, the company announced plans to cut its capital budget by 58% compared to last year. And that's a pretty big deal, according to Stephen Beck, who analyzes North American shale plays for the global consulting firm IHS.
The noteworthy thing about Cabot is that it's located, its operations are located in some of the best areas of the Marcellus in northeast Pennsylvania. And these are the wells in these areas are some of the most economic wells in the Marcellus.
Other major companies have also announced cuts this year. Southwestern Energy laid off nearly 40% of its workforce, including 200 jobs in Appalachia. Range Resources cut 55 jobs, and Chesapeake Energy saw its stock plummet as it fended off bankruptcy rumors after hiring a restructuring firm. The downturn has rippled through related industries, too. Clayton Bubeck is with the Lancaster-based engineering firm Ritu. He says the Marcellus boom was a shot in the arm just at the right time in 2008. Despite the Great Recession, Ritu was able to open new offices, and their workforce more than doubled to nearly 500 people. But suddenly, nearly all their business was oil and gas.
We really didn't understand what that cyclical nature was going to be as well as maybe we should have.
2 years ago, the company decided it needed to diversify, to insulate itself from the booms and busts of the industry. Today, Bubeck says Ritu has just under 400 employees and does about half its business in the overall energy sector, including some growing renewable industries.
And that's just the way oil and gas is. And it's just a commodity-based industry that when they're making, it's capitalism, when they're making money, they're drilling, they're doing work, and there's no time. You have to get it in now because I can make a lot of money now. And when the prices are down, they retract and try to keep all that money in-house.
Statewide, Marcellus gas production peaked last year and then started to slide. There are now just 19 rigs running in Pennsylvania. That's fewer than there were in 2008, before the boom took off.
It's really difficult for them to justify keeping all the rigs out there.
Lynn Westfall heads the Office of Energy Markets and Financial Analysis for the U.S. Energy Information Administration. It's the statistics arm of the Department of Energy. He says production declines really quickly from new wells, so companies have to keep drilling new ones just to keep up the pace.
So that's why production is going down, in that the new wells aren't making up for the loss from the old wells. So until you see the rig count go up into the mid-60s, you're not going to see production increases. As a matter of fact, you will see production declines until you get to that point.
And less gas means less work. The most recent 2015 figures from the State Department of Labor show a loss of more than 2,200 oil and gas jobs compared to the same period in the previous year. And the slump is also hurting state coffers. Royalties from drilling on Pennsylvania forest land have dropped sharply this year, and gas companies will also pay less in impact fees, which have become an important source of revenue for local governments. But as an analyst watching all this play out, Stephen Beck says it's important to remember one thing.
The important thing is that the industry does go through these boom and bust cycles, as everyone knows, and the industry will get through this low-price period as well.
And Governor Tom Wolf is still advocating for a new severance tax on gas production. Last year, his proposal didn't get enough legislative support. This year, his administration expects his new plan would bring in just over $200 million. It's a small fraction of the $1 billion they'd hoped for last year. And this time, Republican lawmakers who have long opposed such a levy are starting to signal they may be open to enacting a tax this time around. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
And just how much is the downturn in the natural gas industry going to hurt state and local governments? According to a new analysis by the state's independent fiscal office, the revenue generated by impact fees will drop 17% compared to last year. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. And now, a little citizen science. Pat Jacobs sees a lot of winter birds in her backyard.
Woodpeckers, nuthatches, chickadees, and dark-eyed juncos, goldfinches, and lots of cardinals.
During a recent winter snowstorm, she looked out the large window of her home in Pittsburgh's southern suburbs, and she saw something else. She knew just what it was.
I grew up in South Texas, and in South Texas, mockingbirds are about as common as robins are here.
But in 35 years, she'd never seen a northern mockingbird in Pittsburgh during the winter. though she snapped a photograph of the gray bird with white bars on its tail feathers as it was fattening up at her bird feeder. And she posted it to icchange.org. That's the online almanac of weather and climate where people post photos, observations, and questions about what they notice outside. She marked the post as weird and added,
I don't know what it's eating as insects are nowhere to be seen.
We called an expert, Luke DeGroat.
I work for the Carnegie Museum of Natural History at Powder Mill Nature Reserve, and I am their avian ecologist and bird bander.
He says northern mockingbirds do eat insects in the summer, but this time of year...
Poison ivy berries are an excellent source of fruit for most birds, and we typically have a negative association with them, but it's really... There's a lot of fat and proteins and antioxidants in those fruits.
The berries stick around on withering stems into the winter. He says it's not unusual for northern mockingbirds to stick around here either, but that not a lot is known about their migration.
They may be a species that more of them are choosing not to migrate south for the winter and warmer years.
Like many of us, these birds prefer warmth, and the unseasonably warm start to this year's winter may have influenced that lone northern mockingbird at Pat's feeder. If you're a recreational birder, like Pat Jacobs, or just someone who pays attention to what's going on out there, in your backyard, or maybe on your way to work, try icchange.org. That's icechange.org. Log in. You can even post directly from your phone and post something just like Pat did.
I thought it was an interesting approach to the average person being able to participate in what is essentially a science project of observations of things that are just going on that are different because of climate change.
Join us at icchange.org. We can't tell our region's climate story without you. While most Americans agree with the vast majority of scientists that climate change is happening, only about half believe that people are causing it. That's according to the Pew Research Center. But how does that kind of thinking trickle down into science classrooms in the U.S.? Eric Plutzer is a professor of political science and sociology at Penn State University. He and his colleagues surveyed 1,500 middle and high school science teachers from all 50 states about how they cover climate change with their students. He joins me by phone to talk about the results. How are the majority of teachers approaching climate change in their lesson plans?
3 in 4 science teachers overall are introducing the topic to their students. The typical teacher, though, is only covering the topic for about 1 or 2 hours.
So why is climate change getting such short shrift in the classroom?
It gets short shrift in part because it is a new science that is not firmly established in the curriculum. Also because the most likely place to teach it is in an earth science class, and that is probably the class that high school graduates are least likely to take.
Are teachers accurately conveying the scientifically accepted facts about climate change to their students?
Not consistently. Of the teachers that do spend some time on the topic, about 85% are telling their students that fossil fuels are the major cause. But of that group, a substantial number are also telling their students that many scientists think that the predominant cause is found in nature and natural fluctuations. When students are being exposed to this topic, roughly 30% are receiving mixed messages from their teachers.
Why is that? Is it because teachers don't have the training and the background to teach climate change?
I think that is part of it. It's helpful to keep in mind that when many teachers were in college and university themselves, many would have been in school in the 1980s, for example, scientists themselves were not as certain as they are today. And it's understandable that they would have been exposed to scientific instruction that emphasized that all the facts were not yet in on climate change. In addition, a typical high school biology or chemistry teacher, for example, when they were in college, would have had to complete their major. They would have had to take courses in developmental psychology and pedagogy and classroom management. And that would have left them very little room to take a science elective in climate science. The majority of our teachers had no formal training in climate science when they were in college. And lacking that training, they get their information from a lot of the same places that members of the general public do. And that can be a difficult place to navigate with lots of politicized comments as well as scientific ones.
What about the teachers themselves? Are they skeptical or uncomfortable with climate science? And could that be coloring their teaching?
We asked teachers, you know, to the best of your knowledge, what proportion of climate scientists think that global warming is caused mostly by human activities? And there have been a number of studies on this, and the numbers that come up are 95% of climate scientists, or 96% or 97%, or even 100%. But fewer than half of our teachers gave the right answer. And many of them perceived far more disagreement in the scientific community than actually exists. If they think that scientists haven't agreed on the basic contours of climate change, then it's understandable that they would open up their classroom to, for example, allow students to debate what the major causes are.
Were there any differences geographically or among older and younger teachers?
Less than you might imagine. Younger teachers were a little more likely to teach about climate change, but that was not really a major factor. Geography mattered in some ways. For example, teachers in energy-producing areas were not that different from teachers in other parts of the country.
The survey results don't really bode well for teaching the future scientists of America, so what can be done about this?
Well, this is going to be a long-term challenge. The first step should be in the pipeline for new teachers, and we would encourage colleges and universities to coordinate their curriculum so that future science teachers are able to get a thorough introduction to the science of climate change while they're in college. For those teachers who are already in the classroom, we were very pleased that a majority of teachers told us that they'd be very interested in taking professional development courses so that they can get up to speed on the science and up to speed on the best ways of teaching it. Certainly, school districts and state boards of education can do their part by adding specific learning goals for different grades so that students are guided through a cumulative curriculum each year, building on the last one, which we do not yet have. And I think taking those steps would go a long way to helping prepare the next generation of citizens to really engage in the policy debates that they're going to have as more and more communities are faced with consequences such as rising sea levels or changing agricultural conditions.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Eric Pletzer is a professor of political science and sociology at Penn State University, and the results of his survey about teaching climate change in America's classrooms appeared last week in the journal Science. Thanks for listening to The Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. I'm Carol Holsapple. Join us again here next time, or find us online on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Allegheny Front.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy. Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation.